You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Karsibayev.
On this episode, I sit down with a global CTO of financial services at IBM, Tom Eck. In this role, Tom is responsible for establishing the technology modernization approach for IBM's largest financial services clients globally. This includes rethinking how a financial services firm interacts with its clients while leveraging exponential technologies to accelerate time to value. Tom specializes in the transformation from legacy technologies and mindsets to a growth mindset, which encourages innovation via agility, namely via adoption of hybrid cloud, AI, machine learning, deep learning, and automation at large scale while applying agile methodologies to deliver radical ROI while managing risk appropriately throughout. Tom is also an entrepreneurial technology innovator and product developer with a track record of bringing $100 million plus products to market in multiple industries. A few interesting factoids about Tom. He's been involved in AI for 25 years. And also, he processed the world's first production Apple Pay payment. This is an exciting episode for you guys today. Please welcome Tom Eck. Tom, thank you so much for finding time to talk to us today on the Ivy Podcast. Can you tell us a little bit more about your role within the organization and what falls under your purview?
Sure. So my official title is I am the CTO for Banking and Financial Markets at IBM. And what that really means is I focus primarily on our largest clients worldwide. And these are, you know, mostly your household name, you know, global banks and some regional banks. So that's kind of like really my scope. But in particular, this year, focused on this new IBM Cloud for Financial Services that we are building in conjunction with Bank of America. So my job really is to expand this globally. Okay, so we want to help our clients get to the public cloud, which has been extremely difficult in the financial services industry.
Well, that's exciting. And I definitely have quite a few questions for you with that regard. On the Ivy Podcast, I've hosted, you know, several executives who are going through various cloud transformation initiatives. So I think to get your insights into that, that would be, you know, very, very interesting. And I understand prior to your engagement with IBM, you spent quite a few years in as an entrepreneur or for smaller companies. I want to get your opinion on that transition from entrepreneurship to corporate or the other way around, the vice versa. Can you share with us any practical recommendations on how to succeed through that transition? What were some of the lessons learned for you have been through that period, and what you wish you knew ahead of time?
Great questions there, John. So, well, first of all, you know, so let's go from a, you know, startup or as an independent consultant, moving from that world into, you know, big enterprise, right? So first of all, as you'd expect, you know, the larger the company, the more kind of rules and structure needs to be in place. It's just physics, right? You need to be able to manage a much larger group of people and resources. Now, with that comes more red tape, more meetings and those kind of things. But you also get more support, right? So there's greater financial runway, so less of that cash burn problem that you know, as a startup you'd be focusing on. And also, you know, working in a larger company, just the probability is you're going to run into, you know, more really smart people, right? So that's, you know, those are good things. Now, some of the things that, you know, you don't realize until you get into is really, though, how much control you have to give up, right? I'm talking about control over the way you run your engineering teams, your timelines, your, you know, what features you want to put into your product. And so, you know, the gloom and doom part of it is sometimes it can suck the creativity and enthusiasm out of the room. Okay. So that's one thing, but I have come to appreciate, you know, both working within a large organization as well as working in a two-person organization. So like for example, at IBM, I have access to IBM research. And as you know, I forget for how many years running now, we are the number one publisher of patents, or recipient of patents rather. And so, you know, being able to tap into that type of creativity and brain power, you know, is something that I would never have access to, you know, as a small company. And I'm going to give one more lesson learned. For those that are making this same transition, be very careful when you are told that, hey, listen, Tom, we want to hire you because you come from a startup background and we want you to bring that culture into our organization. And we're going to let you operate your team or your division or whatever as a startup. That could be a trap. Okay. I don't think there's really such a thing as a real startup. I haven't seen it anyway, as a real startup running inside of a larger enterprise. What I have seen work are kind of, you know, innovation centers that are centers, you know, that are like some type of arm's length distance from the mothership, if you will. Okay. So that's what I have to say. Now, I don't know the opposite yet, because I have now been in corporate world for a number of years. Maybe one day I will go back to the startup world. So I'm sure that will have a set of shocks all of its own, probably mostly related to financial, you know, things, because it is nice to have a dependable paycheck coming in, mm-hmm. and you're not always chasing the next round of funding to make sure everybody can eat. So going back to a startup world, I think it's the harder transition to make.
Right. I couldn't agree more with you. I've done both myself, and you know, there's definitely a lot of the pros and cons, and it's just, you know, a lot of the insights that you're sharing resonate well in terms of just reminiscing of the times when I left a very, very stable job to go back to, you know, to founding my own company. And then after, you know, the exiting and going back to the corporate, it's just been very interesting transitions back and forth. You've mentioned a little bit in your response around innovation. It's a personal interest of mine in terms of how other executives really foster that, you know, the whole culture of innovation within the organizations, whether that's, like you said, two-person startup, or if it's, you know, multi-million, you know, organization. From your standpoint, especially during current times, when we look at, you know, companies, you know, downsizing, you know, furloughs and so forth, a lot of the unfortunate events, what strategies are helping you to consistently help, you know, come up with innovative ways to solve certain problems and really motivate your teams to do so?
Yeah, I mean, innovation is like one of those, it's one of those things like having an app go viral. Like if I knew the formula, you know, I'd be a trillionaire by now, right? So it's not an exact science. It is completely a creative form of art. And it can be sometimes done independently. So for example, I've come up with some product ideas that have gone on to be, you know, very, very successful products in the market. When I am in a, how can I say this, intentionally non-mindful mindset. Okay. So I'm, you know, I'm not trying to force myself to think of something innovative, but rather it's got to come to you. So I will have the problem in the back of my head, right? You know, what's an unmet need in you know, in the banking industry for, I don't know, small and medium businesses that has changed due to COVID, right? So that might be kind of my problem statement, but typically I will get let's say an inspiration or a glimmer of an idea when I least expect it, right? So maybe I'm out surfing and I'm waiting for a wave, which is really what I do mostly when I surf. Or I'm out running, or even in my car is also a really good place to not be thinking. It's kind of the mindfulness meditation, mm-hmm. In a sense. I never really made that connection to now, but from a solo effort, that's how kind of innovative ideas come to me. Not in a very structured meeting. But I think that's the harder approach. I think what's even better than that is, you know, getting a few very creative people together. Well, maybe now we have to do that virtually, but in any event, you know, maybe 2, 3, 4 people who are not afraid to have a quote unquote bad idea, because there are no bad ideas, right? So we got to look, you know, find people who understand the problem, maybe somebody who has an understanding, you know, and that is a subject matter expert in that domain, and then literally just throw things up on a board. And more often than not, I have actually seen, I guess you can call this brainstorming, but I've actually seen this work more often than not. So even if we're talking about downsizing and things like that, innovation, I think, comes from the few. It doesn't come from the masses, right? And these people are kind of hard to find. But when you do find them and give them the right environment and give them the latitude to think and even get things wrong, then I think the magic happens.
Yeah, and I think one keyword that stood out as you were talking about this is really that unintentional innovation, so to say, where you really focus on problem solving versus really trying to, you know, that innovation aspect. Because at the end of the day, it's, you know, also there's no such thing as bad idea when you try to collaborate with others and come up with, you know, that innovative way to solve a problem. I think that's, you know, a very interesting concept, and, you know, thank you for sharing that. To switch topics a little bit, in terms of what you're currently responsible for, what are some of the barriers that the financial technology companies face when it comes to their collaboration, or, you know, the partnership with larger financial institutions as banks, you know, the ones that you've mentioned? What are the potential risks when it comes to that? If you have any practical examples or case studies, I guess, of course, to the extent that you can share, because some of our listeners, you know, are in that space, and some of our founders of smaller startups in the space. So I think that would be interesting to get your opinion on that.
Yeah, sure. So let me start with an anecdote. This might now be urban legend by now, but I think it's very illustrative of a very real issue out there. So let's talk about the relationship, first of all, between fintechs and banks. And when I say banks, that's just shorthand for any type of financial institution. Mm-hmm. Okay. About 3 years ago, kind of when I first joined IBM, my day job really was to build a fintech ecosystem for IBM. So I got to work with lots of really cool fintechs. Some of them have recently been purchased by, one was by Visa, another by MasterCard, and they did extremely well. But nonetheless, 3 years ago, the relationship between banks and fintechs was pretty adversarial, right? It was, I think Jamie Dimon said, you know, Silicon Valley is coming to eat Wall Street. And literally, quite literally, you know, some of these fintechs were eating the lunch of the banks. And so it was kind of a zero sum game, and it was adversarial. Okay. Then I would say 2 years ago, that kind of evolved into more of a, I don't know, either a co-opetition or cooperation. And that's when you started seeing banks, you know, starting to, you know, maybe say, let's say, kick the tires on some real, what could I call, kind of core functionality, mm-hmm. that the fintechs were offering that the banks would like, you know, they could, rather than build it themselves, the fintech already has it, and it's easier just to tap into that. Now, at that time, one major U.S. bank had 80 proofs of concept going. So that's 80 proofs of concepts with, you know, approximately 80 fintechs. And they were very enthusiastic by the level of innovation and the creativity and how quickly, you know, the fintechs could iterate and build product and all that. But this person said to me, you know, that's all great, but not one of those 80 POCs will ever see it into production. They will never get into production. So why is that? So here's what I kind of observed. It all comes down to risk. Okay. So at a bank, I think, you know, one of the main concerns at a bank is around risk, right? How risky is the book of mm-hmm. investments? How risky would this loan be? There's also operational, you know, and technical risk, you know, hey, should we deploy this cool feature right now? And you know, the job of the chief risk officer and other IT folks at a bank is to say no, right? The immediate answer is no, because that seems to be the least risky thing to do, because any change could break the bank, right? So that's one end of the spectrum. Now let's go to the other end of the spectrum with fintechs, okay? Their answer to everything, yes, go, yes, we'll worry about the broken glass later on. Mm-hmm. Now, some fintechs have gotten into trouble. They got recently in the last year, you know, we've had a couple of fintechs that got a little bit ahead of their skis and started offering products that they weren't really allowed to, and they had to take them back from the market, and that wasn't good. But the point is that you have these entities at opposite ends of the risk spectrum. So when they come together, it's really like they're speaking two different languages, and there's been a lot of trouble kind of finding the middle ground. So a very concrete example of that is, so, you know, many institutions, banks and non-banks have a vendor review process or a vendor onboarding process, right? So if a bank wants to start purchasing paper from Dunder Mifflin Paper Company, they will have to, for example, the bank will typically have, we did a survey once, somewhere between 200 and 400 steps of a vendor review process. Wow. In order to get them on this list. Right. Now, and what's that all about? That's largely about risk, mm-hmm. right? That's largely about risk. And now imagine you're a fintech and, you know, you're one of these 80 that this bank liked and the bank is now like, you know what, we think this is such great technology and will serve our clients so much that we want to move ahead. All we need to do now is get you through the vendor review process. Now, a fintech doesn't have an army of lawyers and you know, risk officers and these mm-hmm. these types of people, and you know, they're going to collapse under the weight of that kind of review process. So this has been a problem that has kind of, you know, plague, maybe is too strong a word right now, but, you know, has plagued our industry. So this is really what this IBM Cloud for Financial Services that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. One of the two main aspects of it is to deal with this issue of how can banks in a more trusted and confident way consume services from third parties. And I'm not talking just fintechs. I'm even talking like your huge SaaS providers, you know, like Salesforce and those types of companies. The banks are saying, we want somebody to help us kind of, you know, lower that friction so that we all don't have to we shouldn't have to take a fintech through basically the same 400 steps. Mm-hmm. We'd rather outsource some of this to IBM. And that in essence is part of what we're doing with this this new cloud for financial services, is we are essentially, you know, certifying the third party software against a regulatory compliance framework. So it makes sure that third party software is adherent to the financial services industry's regulations. And this is something that the industry has needed for a long time. We're in early stages of it. And basically the industry says, you know, this is an IBM sized problem and an IBM type of problem to solve. So hopefully we're going to do something to help get, you know, these entities at the opposite ends of this kind of risk curve to come together. And hopefully we're going to be able to find that middle ground.
That's very interesting and definitely sounds like a gap that needed to be, you know, have some type of solution to it. I can relate to it, and to a certain extent with us at ProSource IT, we, at the end of the day, we are a vendor to a lot of organizations of various size. Whereas we provide, you know, the niche IT staffing services and management consulting and training. So for us, when we start our partnership with organizations of, you know, Fortune 500 size, you know, I can definitely also relate to some of the, you know, these risk mitigation strategies that you're talking about as part of that vendor onboarding process. And that's, you know, it's just interesting to find the correlation between the fintech and the financial industry in general to what we do. So thank you for some of those examples. Mm-hmm. In terms of kind of that, the whole advanced technology space with RPA, machine learning, AI, I'm curious to get your opinion as they are reinventing the software engineering and kind of the information technology as a whole. How do you think these trends will impact your space, your industry, from the innovation standpoint? And what are your thoughts on best strategies to adopt such technologies? Because as I spend a lot of time with other executives, you always hear some of the, you know, those, you know, it's a big hype. It's a, you know, everyone's talking about it. But when it comes to the actual, you know, utilization, implementation of such technologies, it's completely different, you know, spectrum. I'm curious to get your opinion on that.
Yeah. So let's see. So first of all, I'm an AI guy from back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, besides the technology, you know, I really take the ethics and the cultural and societal impacts of AI into account in everything I do. And I agree with IBM's approach where they consider, you know, we use the term augmented intelligence, right? Now, some mechanical things that I would call, you know, they're obvious applications of RPA, and, you know, there's no additional value for a human to be in the loop. The human should be doing something that the machine can't do. I think that, you know, there's some very straightforward things, especially in middle office and back office. Mm-hmm. I see lots of applications for RPA, and we're seeing that kind of take off. But when we kind of get into the more kind of esoteric, you know, AI and machine learning, deep learning, I think it gets a little bit more difficult. Again, there are some, you know, embarrassingly obvious problems that, you know, AI has been great at solving, such as, you know, like customer segmentation, even prediction of life events. There's some amazing things that we're doing in the industry at IBM. But one thing that I don't think AI is going to be able to do on its own anytime soon, I think, is innovation itself. I think innovation itself is reserved for sentient beings. You know, I can develop an ML model to make it look like it's innovating because it can make lots of guesses, and it can, you know, it can just basically throw a lot of things up on the wall, but not in kind of the, not with the creativity of a human being. So first thing is, I don't think AI is going to, you know, not in the immediate future anyway, be an engine of innovation itself. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now I could, 2 years from now, I could be completely wrong, and feel free to rerun this part of the podcast. what I do find interesting though is, you know, there's a concept in a lot of machine learning models, called, you know, exploration and exploitation. And that's kind of like, I guess if you think about it, it's playing a game. Let's say it's learning to play a game. And it develops a strategy that seems to be working very well. So it will exploit that strategy, you know, over and over and over. But how do you know that there's not a better strategy? So what you also build into these models, it's called exploration. So exploration is kind of like it randomly, you know, tweaks the strategy and sees if a better one comes up. So, and then you can kind of balance these two things. So you might say, you know, 95% of the time, go with what we know works. 5% of the time, you know, think outside of the box, go try it. If it doesn't work, you know, we'll try something again later. I think it's that exploration aspect of machine learning models that could be used as an engine for innovative ideas. So almost like leads, almost like, I'm making this up right now, like an innovation lead generator that, you know, these innovative ideas would then be taken by humans and kind of, you know, expanded upon. So I think that's something that could be pretty interesting. And, you know, another very straightforward application is even in just observing how a user interacts with an app. And you know, an AI model can be trained to kind of look for where there seems to be friction or where a user is getting stuck, or, you know, too many buttons are being pressed. And it's kind of like one of these, you know, game optimization kind of problems where we can apply it to, you know, like I'm saying, apps or any other experience. It could be a face-to-face experience. And we can kind of optimize those experiences in a you know, through the use of machine learning models.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting perspective, and I'm pretty sure we could have a whole separate episode just on that particular topic in general. So thank you for summarizing that in the concept. What stood out is that kind of the augmented intelligence concept that you've talked about, and also that exploitation versus the exploration aspects of that AI strategy implementation. Those are very interesting. To shift topics a little bit further, when it comes to most kind of in-demand skill sets these days, in the current market and with the current conditions we're dealing with. Nowadays, I'm curious for the teams or the divisions that you manage that are under you, what are the most in-demand skill sets that you guys are looking for, and which ones are the most challenging to find? And I'm also curious to get your opinion on what strategies do you deploy to kind of attract this top, highly, you know, in-demand skill set?
Right. So I would say, you know, for hands-on roles, you know, where you're, you know, hands-on keyboard, those types of roles, it's really three things: cloud, data, and AI. So for example, for cloud ops, cloud operations is huge, right? There's not enough people in the world that really understand Kubernetes, how to set up clusters, how to secure them, to scale them, you know, and, you know, just generally how to operationalize them. Huge, huge demand for cloud operations, as an example. In the data space, data science, without a doubt, is highly, highly in demand. For AI, and, you know, I'll throw, you know, all the variants of AI in there, you know, machine learning and deep learning. Anything related is hugely in demand. Okay, now those three roles are the most in demand, and just due to market forces, that also means they're some of the highest paying jobs in the industry. Okay, now for hands off roles, like more of a management role, I think you should go find something hands on to do. I think we're going to be seeing, maybe instead of kind of having your, what can I call it? Like the doers and then the middle management and executive management. I think middle management is going to continue to kind of get downsized and squished out. Yep. Especially when you adopt an agile, software mindset, because the idea is that those agile teams are independent. They don't need a middle manager to project manage them. So if you are, which is not to say that there shall not and will not be middle managers, but I think for those roles, in my space, I think though, if you're going to manage a team that's doing technology development, I think you should have a background in technology development. Okay, it's not like what we're seeing. There's a trend in American professional football where we're seeing kind of this new breed of coaches who are being quite successful, but they've never played pro football themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of an oddity in sports. Usually, you've played the sport. That's not how it is in my industry. In my industry, you're far better off having played pro football, or in my case, pro technology development. Because if you don't, the gap of understanding between like a middle manager and a developer, there's such a chasm there that just I see it time and time and time again. Complete misunderstandings. So much of it is related to miscommunication as the reason why features get missed, deadlines get missed, things get overpromised. All of that, I think, a lot of that can be solved if the manager has a proper, background in technology development. And I don't mean reading, the Idiot's Guide to technology development. I mean, you've been in the trenches. You've gone through, terrible bugs that you got to find and outages and kind of all of it. You have to have lived through that, I think, to be able to manage it. So that's what I would say about what skills. Again, I would say cloud operations, data science, and, anything hands-on with AI, I would say are the most in demand.
Well, I love the direction you took that response with, because we deal with that on a daily basis with the work that we do at ProSource. And before I joined the organization, I was, it's a lot smaller company. But before that, I was part of, large corporations. And when I joined ProSource, one of the strategies that I discussed with my CEO is really in order for us to really differentiate ourselves from, all other staffing companies and IT recruitment firms is really to bring on board these practitioners, so to say, that, for example, we brought in a former agile coach or, an actual scrum master who's led these initiatives and transformations for large organizations. And now she, she's done that type of work and she's able to relate to a lot of the candidates that she's talking to on a daily basis that may be a good fit for that particular team that she's trying to fill. Same goes with, from cloud or, site reliability engineers for us is high demand and very hard to find. So we were successful in attracting that type of skill set to join our team, who is able to, almost weed out through that initial assessment of the candidates and as well spend quality time with the hiring manager to understand their needs, because they've done that. They've been there before. So that's, just a similar analogy to what you were talking about. And, if a middle manager has not been a software engineer himself in the past, it's going to be very hard for them to, even to build that initial rapport with the teams that are under them. So I couldn't agree more with you.
Yep.
And last but not least, when it comes to the actual interview hiring process, can you, to the extent that you can you tell us a little bit more, what does the interview look like with you, for example, or within, any of your teams? Do you get creative? Do you keep them pretty traditional? And what do you look for in some of the responses that the candidates, aside from the, specific technical skill set?
Right. So the way that I've approached it is I kind of let my most senior developers take care of the, the techie part of the interview, right? So if you're showing up and you're telling me you're a C++ programmer or whatever, well, you got to prove that you got chops, right? Yep. And I let my folks do that. And my folks, wherever I've been, because these are the type of people I pick, are no, they're universally hated by recruiters, because more often than not, the candidates don't get past the technical rounds. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would rather, you know, I think most people would, you know, I would rather hire a team of, you know, 8 A list and, you know, a couple of B list rather than have 50, you know, B's and C's, right? So I really am looking for the cream of the crop. So my folks know that, and they do a very comprehensive job doing the interviewing. And look, it suits the candidate as well. We're not asking questions like, why is a manhole cover round or anything like that, right? Like we literally just want to know if you can, if you're up to the task of doing the code that you would be doing in this role, right? Exactly. So I think it's fair. Now, once a candidate gets past that gauntlet of the technical interviews, I'm the last person that they will meet with. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking really for fit and finish at this point. And to be very specific, it's mostly about cultural fit. It's how well do I think this individual is going to fit in with the team? And, you know, with especially with agile teams, trust is such a major part of a team working together as a team. And just one bad apple really can spoil a good agile team. I'm not sure that's how that slogan goes, but something like that. And I've seen it. It's really disruptive. So I kind of just ask, you know, some softball questions so that they don't really have to put on their quantitative, you know, brain. And I just want to kind of get a feel for who they are as a person. Uh-huh. And then the last thing I tell the candidate is, you know, in most of the roles I've had, it's been on kind of under the spotlight, let's say, right? And I tell the folks this. I say, listen, if you like being in the spotlight, you'll really like being on this team. Now, the spotlight shines on the good and the bad, and you have to be up for that, right? So if you're looking for a really challenging role that you're going to you know, I think you're gonna really enjoy and get a lot out of. But be kind of under the microscope because of the nature of the scope of the projects we're working on, for products we're building. You know, then this is the team for you. But if you don't like that and it's not for everybody, then you know, why don't you just think about that? So that's kind of how the interview process goes for me.
Interesting, and thank you for that insight. And there you go, for anyone who is about to have an interview with one of Tom's teams, you guys got some insider information. So appreciate the insights. But I agree with you in terms of really kind of from the concept of what you talked about, the bad apple, really, especially with agile teams, you know, self-sufficiency is, you know, the one of the key objectives. And if that person is not the right fit, and it could really derail, you know, the morale and, you know, the whole chemistry of the entire team. So that's extremely important. Tom, last but not least, what are you currently reading? And what is one book, if it's different from what you're currently reading, that you always recommend to others? And why is that?
Okay, so so first of all, I am a nerd. And I read only nerd things. So when it comes to history, like for example, I only care about the history of math and computer science, for example. But I love hard sci-fi. Yeah, I know. But I love hard sci-fi. So I got turned on to this book that I'm just starting to read called Accelerando by Charles Strauss. I got turned on to this book by watching probably the best explanation of quantum computing that I've seen by a young MIT researcher. I saw it on YouTube, who really explained quantum computing better than I've ever heard. And he happened to mention this book. And I said, well, this guy's brilliant. Maybe I should go take a look at this book. So I've just started reading that. So if you have not read Hard Sci-Fi, Yeah. Neuromancer by William Gibson. That is the original cyberpunk book. You got to read that. It's a short read. That's Neuromancer. And I'm going to throw in a bonus one. It's called Flatland. It's also super small. It starts by describing a worm in one dimension and what a two-dimensional world would look like. And then evolves into a three-dimensional world like ours and where the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh dimensions might be and why we can't see them. Really interesting to get your head around. And the other interesting thing is that the author of that book, Flatland, wrote it in 1884. His name is Edwin Abbott Abbott. So I don't know. I guess his family really liked the name Abbott, and they named him twice. So Edwin Abbott Abbott, Flatland, learn about one-dimensional worms. There you go.
Well, that's great. And for our listeners, as always, we'll make the titles of these books and authors available in the episode notes. Tom, can't thank you enough for making the time to talk to us today. I personally learned quite a bit through this very short conversation. As with a lot of guests, I'd love to do, you know, another episode in a couple of years to see how much I've changed, how much, you know, was proven true and not true. So I'm definitely looking forward to staying in touch, and we really appreciate your time today.
Hey, right, thanks. Thanks so much, John. And thank you. Thank you to the listeners for listening to this. I had a really good time doing this.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.